طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week we are pleased to feature a presentation by Anna Balzer, who is, among other things, an organizer for the U.S. campaign to end the occupation, and in that capacity has her finger on the pulse of organizing all over the country. Here she speaks at a peace action conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota, that took place in November of 2014. It is, among other things, a wonderful rundown of the status of the BDS campaign. But beyond that, she also offers some sage advice to all who are organizing around the BDS campaign and pro-Palestinian effort across the country. The presentation begins with her introduction. Here is Anna Balzer of the U.S. campaign to end the occupation.
I'd like to call Anna Balzer to the front. I've known of Anna for a number of years and always been impressed by her work and her presence. And I would like to tell you a few things about her. She's a Jewish-American public speaker, author, and activist for Palestinian human rights. At the present time, she is also the national organizer for the U.S. campaign to end the occupation. After graduating from Columbia University, she traveled to the Middle East in 2003 on a Fulbright grant to teach English in Ankara, Turkey. Since then, she has traveled to the West Bank as a volunteer for the International Women's Peace Service to document human rights abuses and support nonviolence resistance. Her publications have documented 8 months of human conditions while on assignment in the West Bank. Today, we are most grateful to have her present with us as she shares more of her experiences with Palestinians and maybe a little bit about the Fourth Precinct. We'll see. So welcome, Anna.
So thank you to Sabil and all the organizers for making this event happen. And thank you, everyone, for being here, especially at 1:30 on a Friday afternoon. I know it's not easy for everybody, so thanks for being here. It's an honor and privilege to talk to you. I'm excited to be able to open up this conference with some commentary on the really amazing, extraordinary place that the state of the U.S. movement for Palestine is at today. I'm actually not going to be, the title of my talk is State of the U.S. Movement for Justice in Palestine, Building Power Through BDS and Joint Struggle. So that's actually going to be the focus of what I'm talking about. I've presented here in Minneapolis several times and the Twin Cities and nearby. I think I was here first in 2006 and then again in 2008, and I was just sort of reflecting on how much has changed really since last time I presented here in 2008, how the situation on the ground continues to deteriorate, and I think we'll be learning about that throughout the weekend, but also the movement for justice in Palestine has achieved milestones that I think were once unimaginable, and were even unimaginable in 2008 when I was last here, so it's really kind of extraordinary to reflect on how much has changed, and I want to comment a bit on that. And I hope this weekend can be a time for both deepening our understanding of the injustices in Palestine, but also committing together to working for justice effectively with clear principles. I called my talk State of the U.S. Movement for Justice in Palestine, knowing, of course, that I cannot possibly give you a comprehensive talk on everything about this movement because it is so big and widespread, and no one one person even can keep track of it, let alone cover it in a one-hour talk. But I'll focus on two things that I think really show where this movement, how far this movement has come, and the power that has been built on a national and local scale to really start to challenge mainstream institutions and the dominant narrative in this country. It is difficult to overstate the significance of the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, a call made to us people around the world acting in solidarity, the way that this call has transformed the solidarity movement for justice in Palestine, putting agency back into the hands of people of conscience, with the Palestinian themselves as our center of accountability. So I want to start by talking about the way that BDS has worked, how it can continue working, and maybe give some concrete ideas, and then shift into talking a bit about joint struggle and intersectional work and how that has also enhanced this movement. So 10 years ago, Palestinian civil society issued a historic call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, similar to those used against apartheid South Africa, targeting Israel and institutional participation in its oppressive regime. And BDS comes in many shapes and sizes, and if we get the PowerPoint up, I can give you some examples of some of the really creative ways in which BDS is playing out around the country and just how widespread it is. But there are boycotts of Israeli goods and other products that are and services that are linked to Israeli apartheid. There's a boycott of Israeli academic and cultural institutions, which are part and parcel, of course, of Israel's military occupation. There is divestment by institutions like churches, like campuses, universities, municipalities, pension funds, banks, foundations, etc., in choosing to stop investing in companies involved in Israeli aggression. And there are other forms of BDS, including, of course, eventually getting to the S sanctions, whereby the U.S. government and governments around the world will impose sanctions on Israel to make it no longer able to continue its oppression of Palestinians. And the goals of the BDS movement are the fulfillment of the basic human rights of the different parts of the Palestinian community and society according to international law. These are uncontroversial rights and goals, namely, one, an end to the 1967 occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, two, equality for 48 Palestinians or Palestinian citizens inside Israel who live as second or third or fourth class citizens, denied the same rights granted to Jews in a Jewish state, and three, of course, the right of return for Palestinian refugees who are living in exile, who are the majority of the Palestinian population. BDS aims for these three basic rights, which are basic conditions of any just and lasting peace. But I want to talk most about BDS the way that I see it, which is as an incredible gift. Many of us were sympathetic with the Palestinian plight for many years. I can remember just how many film screenings we tried to do, speaking events, etc., and people wouldn't come, or it was always the same people who came, right? Vigils with always the same people, feeling like we're not getting anywhere, writing letters to Congress and getting back either no response or something comically terrible in response. There was a time that I remember even, and for people who've been doing this work for decades longer than myself, I'm sure you have even more examples, when I think a lot of solidarity activists, we were asking ourselves, what does it mean to work in solidarity with the Palestinian people, who are, of course, the leaders and primary agents of their own freedom struggle? And how can we actually affect change? And BDS has helped us answer this question, helping us see our specific role as solidarity activists, and it's also given us an extraordinary tool to build our power, and that's what we see playing out today in this country. And we have lots of evidence of it that I can talk about, and other speakers will be talking about as well, beginning to influence real change. BDS has moved people from sympathy to concrete, effective action in the form of campaigns, guiding all of us to investigate the ways in which we ourselves are implicated in Israel's oppressive systems and to work to end that complicity. Because put simply, BDS is about ending our complicity and our collective compliance with Israeli apartheid. So every person in this room is implicated in multiple ways in Israeli aggression. And it is your job, it is our job, to investigate, to find out how, and to work to end that complicity. That's what BDS is really at its core. And it's not something heroic. Palestinians are not asking of us something heroic to end our harm. It's a basic moral obligation. And by demanding that we end our participation in Israel's war crimes, BDS is doing two things. First, it holds us accountable, as it should. But more importantly, it's giving us back our power. We are no longer waiting for President Obama or the U.S. Congress, or certainly not the Israeli government, to make change, because we are forcing that change ourselves with leadership from the Palestinian people themselves. And while the opposition will characterize BDS as nefarious and scary, we know, and violent even, terrorism even, they say they call it, we know that BDS is a nonviolent tool to address the extreme brutality and violence of Israel's occupation and apartheid policies. BDS utilizes well-tested, time-honored tactics in the legacy of the South African anti-apartheid movement and other anti-colonial, anti-racist freedom struggles. And it's working. For the first time in decades, the opposition is being forced to respond to us. We are on the offensive. Our movement is now defining the terms of the discussion. It's incredible. It's incredible. By bringing BDS to your community, you can take something that feels to many people as something very far away and international. We know it's not. But it feels that way to so many people, and localize it. Turning it into something that's a local issue, that the occupation is everybody's problem, and remaining neutral is not an option any longer. And as BDS resolutions come up for votes in municipalities, church assemblies, universities, and beyond, BDS is challenging people who could once ignore Israeli aggression, who could decide not to come to our film screenings or our vigils or our presentations, to finally take a side, to investigate what this is all about, and to figure out where they stand. Because we're bringing the occupation home, we're putting it on trial, and people have to confront the situation and learn about it. And in that way, BDS is actually, in my opinion, by far the best educational tool that we've ever seen. And now, according to a number of Israeli politicians, top business leaders, mainstream journalists, the wisdom seems to be that the only way to stop BDS and to avoid growing Israeli isolation is to restore Palestinian rights. In other words, BDS is working. We also know that BDS is threatening the status quo, given just how much the opposition is doing to fight it. And I believe that Cecily Zaraski from Jewish Voice for Peace, who's another plenary speaker, is going to be talking more about the ways that the Zionist establishment is fighting BDS and how we can counter that and resist it. So in the less than 10 years since the BDS call's inception, the BDS movement has established itself truly as a force to be reckoned with, and we have achieved milestones once unimaginable. The list is long and growing every day, so I would like to name a few of the ongoing campaigns and victories. It would be really cool to see some of the images. And as I was sort of talking about different types of BDS, so boycott, for example, consumer boycotts, targeting things like Israeli dates made on illegal Israeli settlements, Hewlett-Packard, which provides a lot of the technology used in racial profiling in the West Bank and the rest of Palestine. Consumer boycotts are one form of BDS. Divestment campaigns, like I was talking about, targeting corporations like these. Caterpillar, of course, providing the bulldozers used to demolish Palestinian homes, and olive groves to build the wall, etc. Technology used to surrounding Israeli settlements and more. These are readily available facts, so I don't expect you to remember all these details, but it's just to give you a sense of actually the breadth of potential targets, and then we'll talk a bit about how we strategically choose targets to have the most effective campaign possible. And I'll be talking a bit specifically about G4S as well, and there's a whole workshop on it, so I won't mention it there. I mentioned academic and cultural boycott, the ways in which Israeli academia and cultural institutions are part and parcel of Israeli aggression, and how, and I can talk a bit about how people can target those institutions. And then, of course, sanctions is very important. Here's kind of a graphic that can help sort of lay out BDS as a strategy for change. You know, ending the occupation, equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and the right of return. Those are those three goals that I talked about. The tagline being freedom, equality, and justice. to match up with those, and then, of course, BDS. So, great. So we've achieved these incredible victories that honestly, I think the last time I was here in the Twin Cities, I don't think any of these had happened yet, and I think that we probably would have thought that they were coming in 20 years, not five. So we have campaigns all over the country, including here in Minneapolis, and it's one of the dots on that map. This is on our website, endtheoccupation.org. I have some brochures out there. But we are a coalition of more than 400 organizations around the country who are working to end all forms of U.S. institutional complicity with the Israeli occupation, including political and diplomatic support for Israeli aggression, and also things like academic, cultural institutions, corporations, etc. And we provide all kinds of support to groups like yours. So talking about some of the victories, students have really led the way in this movement, both, by the way, on BDS and on joint struggle, which I'll be talking more about later. But we see student divestment campaigns and other BDS campaigns unfolding on campuses around the country. These are predominantly often Palestinian-led student organizations. And here is a list that I compiled that is now, I notice, out of date, actually. I mean, there's so many, you can barely fit them on one slide anymore, of just how many different victories we're seeing around the country. It's extraordinary. One of my favorite examples that happened just this year are when students at Wesleyan University, who had been demanding divestment from the Israeli occupation, from fossil fuels, and from private prisons, as they were unable to get any response from the administration and had tried all kinds of other tactics, escalated by actually occupying the offices of the university president to demand divestment, refusing to leave, even I think staying overnight or for many hours in any case, camping out. And lo and behold, eventually the president actually agreed to divestment from one of these three, from private prisons, which is an extraordinary victory and shows the way that I think students are really escalating the tactics in a very effective way at a great time to do it. And it's just very inspiring to learn from. And there's a really good video, actually, on it online, if you Google it. Churches, of course, especially presenting at our Friends of Sibil conference, churches have been really leading the way as well, particularly on divestment, as well as boycott with the Presbyterian Church of the United States, the United Church of Christ. We have folks I worked with on the ground, I think, in both of those here today. This is a screenshot that we saw on June 30th of this year of the UCC vote for divestment, as well as boycott, divestment from the Israeli occupation. It wasn't even close. It was amazing. I still get chills when I see this screenshot. You know, the Presbyterian Church, which is incredible. There was a 7-vote spread, so it was 50, 0.001 versus 49.999. Wasn't even close this summer. So we see again that momentum building and the power that we're amassing, and also how awesome the UCC church is. Quakers preceded both of those. The Friends Fiduciary Corporation divesting from these different corporations involved in the occupation. I'll be talking a bit about Veolia as well, but that started several years ago already. And this is a similar sort of roundup of some of the biggest divestment victories that have happened, not just in the United States, but worldwide. And these are big deals. This is the Dutch ASN Bank. We're talking about national pension funds. We're talking about, major churches, pension retirement fund giants, the Bill Gates Foundation, et cetera, billionaire George Soros. This is no longer can we say that BDS is just about being symbolic. And just about changing the discourse, we're actually seeing money moving in a way that is significant. One of the most exciting victories of this year, of course, was when R&B and I think 8-time Grammy Award winner Ms. Lauryn Hill of the Fugees previously heeded the call from Palestinians and their allies around the world, asking her to cancel a performance in Tel Aviv to hear that BDS call, and she did, in fact, and she joins a list of more and more cultural performers who are understanding that there can be no business as usual with an apartheid state, that it is wrong to go and perform in Israel when we know that Palestinian artists, for example, cannot travel outside, cannot be artists themselves, cannot even attend something like Lauryn Hill's concert. Another amazing victory of just the last year, of course, is Block the Boat. So Zim Shipping Company, Israeli shipping company, which docks in places around the country, including on the West Coast, was stopped by extraordinary coalitions all along the West Coast, blocking the boat, working with workers at the docks in places like Oakland, to work with them, to support them in supporting the Palestinian struggle. By refusing to unload goods from these Israeli ships, and they haven't been back. It's an amazing victory that really builds on the legacy of the anti-apartheid movement. SodaStream is, of course, a classic BDS victory. SodaStream being a homemade sort of seltzer water maker that for many years was produced primarily on stolen Palestinian land in an Israeli settlement. And there were SodaStream campaigns all over. In fact, was there one in here in Minneapolis? Yes, there was. Absolutely. In fact, Minneapolis, of course, is where Target is headquartered. And I remember activists here actually delivering a petition of almost 10,000 signatures to Target. Among probably many other things you did here. And I'll mention this later, but of course there's a wealth of experience here locally in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota on BDS campaigns that there is much to be learned from. But just this year, SodaStream finally has well, they haven't entirely shifted, but they are moving their factory headquarters out of the West Bank. Of course, they are now moving on to more stolen Palestinian land in the Negev, and so they remain complicit and remain a BDS target. But the fact that they moved their headquarters out of they're moving their headquarters out of the West Bank really shows the power of BDS to change corporate policies. So we see that sort of that we're getting stronger and stronger. So I want to talk a bit about Veolia, especially in light of the focus, one of the focuses of this talk being on joint struggle. So Veolia is a multinational French corporation that focuses on trash waste collection, water, transportation, and energy. And it's everywhere if you start looking for their logo, which I don't have on a slide, But I didn't even know they existed, and then now I see them everywhere. But Veolia was really a flagship BDS target, and it started in Europe, and then there were more and more campaigns happening actually in the United States and around the world to do things like stopping local contracts with Veolia, because Veolia was deeply complicit in Israel's occupation and apartheid policies through providing services to settlements, through their involvement in the Jerusalem Light Rail, entrenching the occupation in Jerusalem, etc. So I worked heavily on a Veolia campaign in St. Louis, where I live, as part of the St. Louis Palestine Solidarity Committee, in addition to my role as national organizer. And we found out, and I give this as an example to learn a bit about what a joint struggle BDS campaign can look like, and then perhaps if it has local sort of implications for you guys and something similar could happen here if it isn't already. We found out that Veolia was trying to gain a contract with our city's water department to what we believe is eventually take over our city's water. It was going to be an incremental, slow thing. But we found out about this at the last minute. Oftentimes it's very hard to find out actually who your city is contracting with, and you find out only when it's too late. But we found out just in time from a leak from a worker who was very disturbed by this, because Veolia, in addition to its complicity in the Israeli occupation, has a history of labor abuses, mismanagement, incredible environmental destruction. It's the world's largest water privatizer. So Veolia is a nasty corporation for many, many reasons. And so we, as the Palestine Solidarity Committee, we wanted to mobilize against Veolia. We had our eye on it. But we knew that we couldn't do it alone, that this was a big campaign. And we immediately, as we found out about the contract, began building a coalition with environmental groups, with whom we had real relationships. One of our members is also a member of the Sierra Club. Club. We knew the people involved in the environmental movement in St. Louis, with workers and with others, to build a strong coalition to challenge this contract. We knew, as the Palestine Solidarity Committee, that environmental and labor groups were not going to rally around messaging for a free Palestine. And we didn't impose any sort of top-down messaging. We were building a coalition to challenge Veolia. That was it. And people were free, organizations were free to approach the campaign from whatever their motivation was, their point of accountability and reference was. But we established some agreements early on, about even if we were all going to approach this from different, from different places, and here you can see one of our protests at City Hall, that we would not throw one another under the bus. So we were all going to fight the Veolia contract, and we were not going to allow ourselves to be divided. And indeed, the mayor, different people at City Hall, as well as national media, frequently were trying to divide our coalition because it was so powerful to see the Palestine movement matching up with labor and with the environmental movement. They saw what incredible power that had. And in building our coalition, we understood that it was okay that different groups could bring different things. So the Palestine Solidarity Committee brought a lot of the organizing capacity. A lot of us had done these types of campaigns before. We were able to give powerful firsthand testimonies about what Veolia's policies meant in practice, having Palestinians testify at hearings to our city council about that. Environmentalists could turn up a lot of numbers, especially in the middle of work days. There were a lot of people from the Sierra Club who were retired or who otherwise were able to show up in ways that a lot of working class folks weren't able to do. So they were able to bring a lot of the people at particular strategic times. Organization for Black Struggle was part of our coalition. We had strong ties with them already through our relationships, which I'll be talking more about. And this could not be a priority campaign for them, and we didn't expect it to be. But they did, for example, an op-ed at a very key moment in our campaign in a major black newspaper in St. Louis, to add to our momentum and at a crucial time. Workers could not be public as part of the campaign. It would have been a threat to their jobs, but they gave us a lot of intelligence when we needed it. They checked in with us. They kept us accountable. So we sort of, building our coalition, what was really important about that, about having such an effective joint struggle campaign, was meeting different groups where they were at and acknowledging that we were all working from a place of good faith and commitment to justice. And in the end, it actually really worked to our benefit because it was actually extremely difficult for the St. Louis powers that be to develop an effective strategy to challenge us because we were everywhere. We appeared to be everyone and everywhere. There was no head. We were decentralized. It was as if the entire city of St. Louis hated Veolia and they couldn't keep track of us. So I think oftentimes when we're building coalitions, especially, we're looking for everybody to participate in an equal way. We're looking for we're looking for other groups to match, let's say, our organizational culture or our organizational style. We're looking for things to be extremely sort of developed in a very sometimes even corporate way of having our goals and how we're going to meet them by which time, et cetera. And what we found was that it was actually very useful for us to allow the coalition to be something that we couldn't control all the time. And we won. And so have a lot of other Veolia campaigns around the world. And just a few months ago, after losing more than $20 billion in contracts around the world following BDS campaigns, Veolia finally pulled out entirely from the Israeli market. An incredible BDS victory, just one of so many. So there are, there's a lot of different campaigns to choose from. I want to look at a few different possibilities and then shift the presentation a little bit. But I do want to just really lift up Minnesota Break the Bonds and the work that it has done over the years building up BDS in this community and just highlight that they are going to be giving a workshop, as well as Tori from Friends of Seville talking about G4S as a target, which I'll mention in this presentation as well. But to really, learn from the experts efforts here in your community. So there's a lot of, you know, different campaigns, and when you're looking at doing one of these BDS campaigns, deshelving Israeli goods at a local grocer, passing an occupation-free Minneapolis resolution in your municipality, perhaps, is your university invested in U.S. companies building the wall and checkpoints, or are they partnering with Israeli academic institutions, or are they hiring G4S, a private security company that helps run Israeli prisons as well as U.S. detention centers? Are they hiring G4S for security? Is your church invested in and profiting from the occupation? A lot of the victories I outlined, there's much more work to be done on those. Are there cultural performers traveling to Israel from the Twin Cities that you might influence to cancel? Or are there Israeli sort of cultural ambassadors coming to Minneapolis that you could protest or stop? Sports boycotts, I want to lift up that I think the very first time I saw sports boycott in this country was here in the Twin Cities when Minnesota Break the Bonds actually mounted a campaign challenging the fact that the Minnesota Timberwolves were going to play the Israeli Maccabi Haifa basketball team here locally. And they weren't able to stop the game from happening, but they ran a great campaign that I think really launched the idea of sports boycott in this country. So I want to lift it up. So I do want to mention two key targets from our standpoint at the U.S. campaign as sort of a bridge into joint struggle work, because these are also corporations that are heavily involved in other injustices. One of them is Hewlett-Packard, which provides technology to the Israeli Navy to enforce the blockade of Gaza, enabling the apartheid system and Israeli checkpoints. They're also heavily contracted with the U.S. Department of Defense and aid the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in deportations and other racist practices in this country, outside of their headquarters. G4S is another key target to look at and to start sort of monitoring its involvement here in your community. It's the largest private security company in the world. It operates Israeli prisons as well as U.S. privatized juvenile detention facilities and a lot more around the world. This is a nasty company. And these are also winnable, I believe, campaigns. These are campaigns that we might be able to see a sort of repeat of Veolia with regard to the occupation specifically. So, there's a lot of great targets. UN is also contracting with G4S. You'll be hearing more about that later this month if you're on our email list. But the most important thing is not having a laundry list of, I don't know, products that you don't buy or companies you don't invest your own dollars in, but really strategically coming together to rally around a specific target, to choose the best target for your context. And I want to talk about some of the criteria that the Boycott National Committee, the Palestinian BDS National Committee, has recommended. And again, I encourage you to go to one of the workshops that's going to talk more in depth about building a BDS campaign. Of course, research, focusing together on one, as I said, looking at your particular context and where you can build power, where do you have influence. And the BNC talks about is the target something that's easy to explain and understand? Is it something that you can describe to people easily? Does it help build power and alliances? So when we're talking about companies like HP and G4S whose involvement in oppression is not limited only to Palestine, but involved in much more, and could be a strategic target for multiple groups. Is it a winnable campaign? Is it something where you can actually have an influence? So these are some things to keep in mind as you pick a target. And there's a lot of support, by the way, out there for you in launching and carrying through with these campaigns, including from our organization, the U.S. campaign. So BDS is one context in which some groups have effectively done joint struggle, like in the Veolia example, but it's really not the only way, or I would say even the main way of doing joint struggle. And I actually think it's a mistake when we approach joint struggle purely from the standpoint of corporations like G4S or HP without really having relationships and common understanding and mutual investment in other struggles. So I'd like to talk a bit about our experience doing Palestine to Ferguson work in St. Louis, where I live, especially given the amazing organizing happening here in Minneapolis following the horrible police killing of 24-year-old Jamar Clark, as Kathy was talking about, who witnesses say had his hands tied behind his back when police shot him execution style recently, and authorities are now refusing to release the tape of what happened. So I encourage people, in fact, I wanted to ask sort of how many people in this room have been up to the 4th Precinct to protest since Jamar was executed? Okay. How many people in this room have been to Black Lives Matter protests or affiliated actions? And how many folks have done work on police accountability, ending mass incarceration, dismantling white supremacy? Okay. I want to talk a bit about sort of what investment in these things has meant in our context in St. Louis and some of the beautiful connections that we've seen being built in an authentic way. So in addition to my national role, I'm also a local organizer with the St. Louis Palestine Solidarity Committee, which is an anti-racist, Palestinian-led Palestine solidarity organization. And in St. Louis, we've seen extraordinary cross-struggle solidarity that is manifesting between Palestine and Ferguson/Black Lives Matter struggles. This has really been happening more and more on a national scale, and we're seeing the connections being made everywhere, at demonstrations, in news articles, at conferences. There was a recent Black for Palestine statement that was incredibly powerful, and an amazing Black Palestinian solidarity video that just came out. I hope you've seen it. Palestinians are reaching out to places like Ferguson, and Black leaders are traveling to Palestine. It's extraordinary to see it happening in so many places, and it terrifies the Zionist establishment because it is really us building power together. And Zionist efforts that have gone back a long time to co-opt Black leaders are failing. Progressive, except on Palestine, so-called PEPs, are becoming increasingly obsolete. And polls show that as the U.S. becomes less white, it is also becoming less supportive of Israel. So I can say that in our context, locally, in the Ferguson movement in particular, the movement has been unambiguously pro-Palestine. It feels as if you cannot go to a Ferguson event without somebody mentioning Palestine and the crowd erupting in a cheer. And I want to talk about how those connections have been made, because I've learned so much from it. And I want to be clear that a lot of what has been done and has been effective has been specifically by Palestinians in the St. Louis PSC. It could not have done by white people. It could not have been done by white people in the PSC. And the role of white people has looked very different, and we have had to learn and respect our different roles in this work, and I'll be talking a lot more about that in detail in my workshop, which is showing up as white allies, solidarity from Palestine to Ferguson, about what it is meant to prioritize Palestinian leadership, and specifically the role of white allies and understanding white organizing culture, those types of things. But from the very beginning, PSC members of all backgrounds have been on the ground taking part in actions, meetings. We were staffing safe spaces. Many of us already had long-standing relationships with radical Black leaders, involvement in the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, in the Organization for Black Struggle, with the issues of racism and police accountability. So we were already engaged and committed. And that's why I sort of put out that question about, you know, what people have done so far, because you really can't just start by trying to make those connections. It really starts with showing up and building those relationships and understanding. Just like at seemingly every Ferguson event, Palestine is mentioned, so too would we never have a Palestine Solidarity Committee event on Palestine that did not place our work in a broader anti-racist framework, challenging anti-Black racism and white supremacy and other forms of oppression. Because we believe that challenging militarization and white supremacy and injustice in Israel is incomplete without also confronting and dismantling those systems here in the U.S. And I'll be honest, it's actually caused some friction in our organization. There have been people who really wanted us to keep really focused on Palestine. And to be honest, that the PSC has not been a comfortable space for all of those people. Some of them have decided to leave. And this has been a hard thing, I think, especially for white folks in the PSC. St. Louis is a nice Midwestern city like the Twin Cities. You know, we want to be nice. We want to make sure everyone feels comfortable. But what we found was that as we were sort of adjusting our politics to be a more comfortable space for white liberal people, we were actually making that a less safe and comfortable space for other people. So what we found is by having really clear principles, we were actually creating a safe space for new people who have joined, and we've become a more multiracial and intersectional organization than we ever were before. I can talk more about what that looked like in practice in my workshop. It also means strategic choices about our messaging. So are we playing to the liberal middle, or are we connecting with organizations of color? Sometimes you can do both at once, but not always. Sometimes you have to choose, and strategically we have chosen generally to be building power with other radical struggles. So anyway, we showed up, and we weren't there waving Palestinian flags or holding signs that said Palestinian Lives Matter. Absolutely not. We weren't carrying our organization's banner. We were there to stand in solidarity, lifting up the central message that became Black Lives Matter. When black leaders called for a weekend of resistance, we helped organize a Palestine contingent. So over and over again, we marched, we took part in civil disobedience, we got arrested together. We showed up there to take part in the struggle at hand. Here's part of our Palestine contingent. Just incredible, beautiful moments of cross-struggle solidarity over and over again. Palestinians from the PSC carried a banner at marches in Ferguson saying Palestine stands with Ferguson. They organized later with other people of color-led organizations to march together behind a banner reading United We Fight. So we showed up without centering Palestine, and that was incredibly important. People recognized the authenticity and drew the connections themselves because of their relationships with us. Connections that I think a lot of us are aware of. You know, that there are very real connections between Palestine and Ferguson and Black Lives Matter. You know, the fact that Israeli police are the same tear gas used against protesters in Ferguson and maybe here in Minneapolis too is used against Palestinians in Palestine, that the same corporations and sometimes people themselves are at the top of a lot of these policies. But knowing these connections and articulating them was not what made our work effective. It was not about having politics. It was about one thing: relationships. Who are you in relationship with? Who are you accountable to? And it was through these relationships, through showing up, through building those things that our work was reciprocal, but it wasn't transactional. It wasn't like we show up for you, so you show up for us. Not at all. They were relationships that made it so that we were understanding the ways in which we might be playing out white supremacy, or we might be making mistakes. In fact, we were making mistakes all the time. And I could give some examples, but actually. Don't. Was that a signal to me to be quiet? I don't know what a time check is. I'll give an example that might be helpful. So about things not being sort of opportunistic, but actually being about building power for each other together. So, Bill Gates Foundation divested last year from G4S. It was a huge victory. We'd run a campaign. It was a Palestinian-led campaign, an international one, coming from the Palestinian BDS National Committee, calling on the Bill Gates Foundation to divest from G4S. In our messaging, in our petition, we gave the example that G4S was running Israeli prisons as well as U.S. detention centers. We used that language to talk about G4S and what a nasty company it was and why Bill Gates should divest, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation should divest from it. And then when they did divest, we put out all of this messaging about victory, amazing, you know, mission accomplished, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation divested from G4S. Turns out a lot of our partners in the prison divestment movement felt a little bit thrown under the bus, because to them, G4S was really actually at the bottom of a long list of companies that are involved in U.S. private prisons. And so we'd sort of used their struggle as part of making ours win. But as soon as we won what we needed, we kind of declared, you know, mission accomplished. We had a similar sort of learning experience we'd learned by that time. time, I believe, with the Veolia victory. So, you know, in August, when Veolia pulled out of the Israeli occupation and Israel altogether, you know, there was a temptation to declare victory and mission accomplished. But Veolia is still violating labor, you know, violating workers' rights all over the world, destroying our earth. It's still the world's largest water privatizer. And so we couldn't have a message of mission accomplished because we had real relationships with these groups that were working against Veolia. And so it allows us to check ourselves and to see where we are being opportunistic as opposed to building power for each other. And that's what it really has come down to. And it's messy, and it's long-term without immediate results, and it's hard, I think, especially for white folks who are used to often defining the pace and direction of everything that we do, including our own activism and including in our activist spaces, dominating those spaces in ways that we might not even realize. But, you know, I can say from personal experience, not ever having had to think about white culture or white organizing culture, or knowing that there was such a thing as white organizing culture, and having paid lip service for a long time about, you know, connecting struggles here with those in Palestine, without realizing the ways that I myself was manifesting white supremacy, even in organizing spaces. There's a lot to learn, I think, in investigating ourselves and doing that personal work, and of how we internalize those things and how they manifest in our work, and the ways in which we end up reinforcing dynamics of power and privilege in ways that are damaging and can actually make joint struggle really challenging or even impossible. So, this is sort of an invitation to white folks who really do want to do that difficult work of joint struggle. If you want to talk of it, and I don't present myself as an expert, I don't think you can ever be an expert. It's a constant process of making mistakes and learning from them. But to continue this conversation in the workshop of what it means to show up as a white ally and do that personal work and understand what white organizing culture looks like and ways that we might be marginalizing people of color in ways we don't even realize. So anyway, I invite folks who really want to do that work to come to the workshop, and we can learn from each other. And with that, I think I will wrap it up. I hope I didn't take more than my time. And if there is time for questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
You have been listening to a presentation to the Peace Action Conference delivered in Minneapolis, Minnesota by Anna Bolzer of the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our feature presentation will be an analysis of the Israeli strategy of occupation by Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.